Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insights and analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program today, the organization Undoing Tax Abuse says it can find 500 billion rand in the budget without raising value-added tax. A Sandton shootout near the Johannesburg Stock Exchange exposes gaps in gun laws and private security. Health experts warn that weak reforms won't cut private healthcare costs. And Microsoft's 25 billion rand investment in South Africa, all well and good, but will it deliver key skills for young South Africans? It's Monday, the 10th of March. The organization Undoing Tax Abuse is claiming that South Africa can find around 500 billion rand in the budget without increasing value-added tax. But how's it going to do that? And what inefficiencies and wasteful expenditure can realistically be cut? And I guess, why hasn't this been done already? The Chief Executive Officer of OUTA is Wayne Duvenage, who joins me now. 500 billion rand, Wayne, that is a lot of money in potential savings. Where exactly is that money being lost or misallocated?
Yeah, hi, thanks, Jeremy. Well, first of all, it's a combination of what is lost and, as you say, not necessarily through maladministration, corruption, just not getting to where they could gain additional revenues. And our lead has taken largely, and a big portion of that, about 330 billion, that's if you have a conservative view on it, comes from Edward Kiesvetter's points that he's raised before the budget speech, to say that if SARS was strengthened and given greater capacity, they would be able to address a lot of where funds are lost through under-invoicing, customs fraud, tax evasion, specifically through high net worth individuals and corporations, illicit financial flows. The list is quite long. Remember, before Tom Moyane came along, there was a lot of that work being done by SARS, which was decimated through this rogue unit accusations. And they really haven't built that capacity. So now you find today, just in alcohol and illicit trade in cigarettes, about 30 billion rand lost. So according to the commission of SARS, they've done their modeling. He puts it at between around about 450 billion. And we're saying, well, if you just got 70% of that, not even all of it, and you start as soon as possible, there's a lot of money that is just left on the table and we're not even getting to it. That was the main area. But we went through 10 other areas, Jeremy, where our work has just shown how we are not how we allowing corruption to take place in the various CETAs, the higher education space. There's also a lot of money that is sitting in accumulated surpluses. Just in the CETAs alone, 55.5 billion rand. Now, you're looking for 60 billion rand as the minister. Well, there's surpluses that these entities are not supposed to be keeping behind. They should just be released back to Treasury and you start to take care of the constraints that they have right now. That's just one area. So as I said, there's 11 of them. There's the dealing with areas such as broadening the tax base. Taxi industry alone is not taxed. I know it created a bit of a controversy when you say that. But, you know, Uber is taxed. Formal bus services and companies are taxed. Why is the taxi industry untaxed? And that's a question that's been answered in Parliament. It isn't taxed, and there's potentially another 9 billion rand there per annum. So
Wayne, you talk about strengthening SARS, improving its capacity. You talk about ferreting out corruption, all well and good, but this is also long-term. You'll concede that raising value-added tax by 2 percentage points is a much simpler way of doing it, although it might be unpopular.
It's too simple, Jeremy, and that's the problem. In the past, when we went from 14 to 15 billion, it was said this was a temporary situation while we get on top of all the other issues, and it never is temporary, and it becomes a long-term thing. So what government goes to is this knee-jerk reaction of taking the line of least resistance. This is quick and easy. What they should be doing. So if it is, for instance, it needs to be temporary, but we're saying, actually, look at all these other opportunities. For instance, the fuel levy, the minister hasn't raised the fuel levy for 3 years, so we commend him on that. But if you're in a tight spot, well, a 50 cents increase in the fuel levy temporarily will give you another 11 billion rand a year. So there's a couple of areas where I think he's not looking at, but going to VAT is the last resort, it's the worst resort. Mm. It impacts on everyone. It's regressive, and we shouldn't be going there while we have all this waste and all this uncollected revenue. And we don't believe that government and Treasury and the Minister of Finance is actually taking all these other opportunities seriously enough.
The problem might be the Treasury is too politically constrained from acting on the recommendations that you have made.
They are. They certainly are. But that's where they've got to change their mindset. You know, Treasury has a lot of power. They keep bailing out municipalities that aren't paying the Eskom debt, which we have to now settle as the public. And what we're saying is there's accountability. There are powers and enforcement mechanisms that Treasury have, which they're not using, or not using effectively enough. And they've got to get their house in order. They've got to start applying pressure where they can apply pressure. We don't believe they do that. And as you say, There's a political lack of willingness in that space, and we believe they've got to start manning up. They've got to start doing their work. Otherwise, they can't keep running to the public to increase taxes. It's just we're at the ceiling now. The Laffer curve shows they can't go to company tax, to PAYE, because it doesn't necessarily bring additional revenue, and VAT is the worst place to go. It's too regressive.
So if government then took some of the suggestions that you've put on the table, again with the point that I've just made about the importance of timeline, how soon could savings be realized, do you think?
Well, we believe just going after following the money in the SARS space, putting the teams together, and they don't have to wait too long. They've got expertise. They might have to put a couple of additional forensics specialists in. They could start going after the illicit financial flows quite quickly. They could increase sin taxes tomorrow by 10% and for another 3 billion rand. They could release those funds in the CETAs, 55 billion rand tomorrow. All of that money, that entire shortfall of 60 billion rand could be done very, very quickly, plus adding a 50 cents onto the fuel levy. These are not difficult avenues to follow, and then deal with all these other issues, but deal with them meaningfully. Stop having the siloed impacts where you have the Financial Intelligence Center working. I'm not saying they don't work together, but they're too siloed with SIU, with SARS, with the Assets Forfeiture Unit. They should be working a lot closer together with the sharing systems and information, and I believe we can get on top of the illicit money flows quite quickly. But it takes a concerted effort, takes project management, it takes political will, and if we just get that right, I think we'll be able to save this country a lot of money.
Having said that, what do you think the best is we can hope for in Wednesday's budget 2.0?
I think you're probably going to see 0.5% in VAT. Hopefully it's also temporary, because that's going to give them, what, about 10 to 15 billion, maybe a fuel levy increase and some sin taxes, and some other initiatives which hopefully will be able to get them across the line for that 50 to 60 billion rand that they're needing. But they're not going to be able to quell the pressures on them for another year unless they start in earnest on these other matters.
Wayne Duvenhage is the Chief Executive Officer of the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you would have heard last week that Microsoft announced a 25 billion rand investment in South Africa's tech and AI infrastructure. It's a big deal, with a key focus on youth employment and digital skills. But the question is, how is this money going to be allocated, and is it really going to create opportunities? Someone at the center of this debate is Ravi Naidu, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Youth Employment Service. Ravi, a very warm welcome to you. So as I've said, this is a big deal as far as the amount of the investment. How much of it will directly benefit young South Africans?
So what Microsoft is doing, Jeremy, is they are providing support in two ways. The one is they're building these massive data centers in South Africa, which will really mean there'll be much better services within South Africa. And that's their physical investment, which is, I think, over five billion rand. So that's by them. And then on the skill side, what they're providing is through the YES program, the Youth Employment Service, they're providing 50,000 certifications, which we would use for the youth who come through our program. So the youth with whatever jobs program they're part of with us, they will also be able to get certification in AI or data science or cybersecurity and so on, which will be very valuable, you know, to have those Microsoft certified qualifications.
And how does this specifically align with current job market demand?
So what YES does, as you know, I mean, it works with the private sector. It's a public-private partnership. And we've done 178,000 youth coming through full-time in the program, working with different companies and different sectors. And in every sector, young people need to be competent and confident in AI systems. So this will mean that the youth in our programs will be able, over and above their work experience, you know, wherever it is, whichever industry, they will also be able to get, many of them, qualifications to do with AI and other cutting-edge tech. So I think it's really would make them much more employable.
Are there specific industries or sectors that stand to gain the most from this investment that was announced?
So clearly our digital sectors, global business services, back office services, the motor industry, mining, financial services would be, you know, the ones who would absorb a lot of people with the technical skills. But it would be the same for retail. You know, if you're in retail or, you know, social and community work, you know, the actual applications are, you know, cut across all different sectors. So I think there would be the more tech-heavy sectors that would benefit the most. But I think given that our youth are right across the economy, I think all of those would benefit.
You'll agree with me that many previous big tech initiatives and investments like this have maybe struggled with execution. How can this be different?
So YES is 100% funded by the private sector. So companies that join the YES program get a certain incentive, government through the government, but it's run entirely through the private sector. And it is the biggest youth employment program by far. So it's run principally at the level of companies. And what we would do is, you know, if I say 178,000 people have come through YES, that means 4.5 million youth have actually applied, 25 times the normal number that we can, you know, have funding for. So we're tending to get very smart young people who come through that filter. So they will be the ones who then get the certification. So, you know, that's how it works. We really have very motivated youth. And then they are the ones who get the certifications, and then they run with that for their careers. So I think that's probably the best way to do it.
All very well, Ravi Naidu, to get the certification, but do you think that the jobs are actually there once that happens? Is the private sector, in other words, moving quick enough in creating those opportunities? And do they actually know what the opportunities are that they particularly need?
So yes, so certainly this, so we have 50,000 certifications this year that we've just finished. 40,000 people came through the program. So we would be giving it to everyone in this year's program plus some of the alumni. And, you know, there is such a shortage of skills, you know, technically competent youth who for companies, that companies are very keen to take these young people because now they'll have work experience plus, you know, a technical qualification, certifications from Microsoft. So I think certainly for that number, we would see a lot of absorption.
We know that this country has a high youth unemployment rate. I'm sure that you've looked at the data. How long before an initiative like this, an investment like this, actually starts to show tangible results? Is it sooner rather than later, which I would imagine is the intention?
Yeah, so we need many things to get youth at on scale into jobs. But what we, including economic growth and all the rest of the big heady things the government and business are talking about, but for us, where we are as the YES program is we do see youth as part of that solution. So the young people are come to through our program, A, are going to be people who are going to building up the professional and middle management layers of companies that allow those companies to employ more people in the future. And we find about 15% of them go on to set up their own businesses. So that's part of growing the economy from the bottom up, as it were, is to have as many technically competent and confident young people, working through the economy.
And just a final one then. This investment is no doubt a sign of confidence in South Africa as far as Microsoft is concerned. Do you think this is going to open the pipeline? Do you think that other big tech companies might follow suit?
Yes, we would hope so. I think Microsoft understands that in this continent, South Africa makes up 60% of their market. So Africa is a very big, influential country. And I think tech companies generally around the world would be seeing South Africa as at least a forward operating base for any investments and work in the continent. So, yeah, so it is very good that Microsoft has put their big data center here in South Africa and Johannesburg in particular.
Appreciate your time. That is Ravi Naidu, Chief Executive Officer of Youth Employment Service. Thank you indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's private healthcare costs remain sky high. I don't need to tell you that. But government's recent decision to only partially implement the health market inquiry recommendations is drawing a degree of criticism. Some experts are arguing this limited approach is not going to fix systemic issues. I want to discuss this in a little more detail. I'm joined by Dr. Aslam Dasu, a steering committee member of the Universal Healthcare Access Coalition. Dr. Dasu, a very warm welcome to you. Why do you believe a piecemeal approach, such as it is, to implementing HMI is simply not workable? What's your thesis in this respect?
On a technical level, these are not the recommendations of the health market inquiry. They're a manipulation of a couple of them. The health market inquiry proposed a comprehensive set of regulation for the private sector. And this was accepted by all parties following that five-year-long process in which everything was, deeply analyzed and agreed to and negotiated. So this composite set of regulations, it's a package. All the pieces hang together. You can't cherry pick one or two things from it, which is what they have done. And the second problem that they have is that they've not only taken those pieces of regulation, they have manipulated them in order to change a very important component of those specific pieces, namely the independence of that process and the way any dispute is resolved through legal arbitration, which gets the thing done, given that medical schemes can't be subjected to anything longer than a few months before they have to set their tariffs. And if there's going to be a review and an argument, which is what the possibility exists in these new published regulations, that may take years. So there's that problem. And then finally, this loss of independence actually creates a problem in that it requires the Minister of Health and the Director General to be arbiters of the situation. It means the process is entirely taken into the Department of Health, which goes against the entire grain of the HMI regulations. So it's got several great difficulties. And last, it creates an exemption framework under competition law that mandates policy and institutional structures that have to be controlled by the Department of Health without any enabling legislation for it. Now, they say that this is going to be part of the NHI, but that part of the NHI has not even been promulgated. So there's nothing that allows for that. So these proposed regulations are on a hiding to nothing legally, and will represent a political humiliation, I think, for the government following its NHI debacle anyway.
Dr. Dasu, what then do you believe the long-term impact is going to be if the recommendations are not fully implemented? And also given that the Minister of Health is calling this, and I quote, a stopgap measure ahead of NHI?
Yes, well, it's not a stopgap measure. That's the first thing. We must set him right on that. These problems around tariffs have been there ever since the new competition law came in. And when we and our CEO of the Board of Healthcare Funders at the time, and we realized that our national negotiations, you know, were collusive in terms of the new competition law. And we went to the Competition Commission and said, this will stop. And it was accepted, and that duly stopped. But ever since then, there has been some difficulty because individual schemes through their administrators would negotiate with individual providers and like members of the hospital association, so a Netcare or a Mediclinic, you know, and they would have to set their tariffs. Now, the only problem with that is that there was nothing mandatory about those because the Medical Schemes Act was promulgated, so it's regulated, but there was no supply-side regulation. In other words, you know, whatever the medical scheme agreed tariff is, the providers need not comply with that. And in fact, what you see is some specialist fees five times the medical aid tariff, putting a burden on the consumer. So we understand this difficulty. And that is why the Health Market Inquiry actually created this multilateral negotiating framework to actually settle that matter so that whatever is agreed is the accepted tariff by the entire industry. So if you don't implement that, you still have this problem. And whether this is a stopgap, I can assure you, it's a sleight of hand. Because it's meant, and this is the real problem for the government. Their NHI Act is mired. It's stuck. They can't implement it because it will require 6 to 8% payroll tax increases. Now, imagine that after the debacle around the 2% VAT increase in the proposed budget. It's not possible to increase taxes in that way. So they can't fund it. Second, they have to change about, I think, a dozen acts of parliament to promulgate the full NHI Act and make two constitutional amendments. In the current milieu, how likely is that to be, you know, possible in the next few years? Third, it will take many years, according to them, to implement their NHI. So we are going to be stuck, you know, with the with this declining public health system, which is the true bedrock of healthcare, and increased and uncontrolled costs in the private sector because there's no proper regulation of it. And last, facing four lawsuits, serious lawsuits on this act. So their act is mired. Politically, the government appears to be at odds with itself. The presidency, the Ministry of Health, the members of the GNU, they're not at idem on this NHI. And that alone tells me that, or tells us, that this is an act of desperation to show some proof of life of their NHI. Because they make it clear that these regulations will form part of the overall NHI rollout in future. So it's utter nonsense. And they should withdraw it completely without any consideration of finding comment on it. It's insensible.
And Dr. Dasu, a very quick answer in conclusion yet. In spite of that, we read today that the health minister is still forging ahead to establish the institutions that are going to run the NHI, despite those legal challenges to the scheme that you have just mentioned to me. So is this now just becoming a politically expedient debate, do you think?
Exactly. And in fact, these new regulations about the institutional framework, you know, they've gotten a 1.4 billion rand budget apportionment for NHI. So they're setting themselves up. They're appointing CEOs and management and a board to control a half a trillion rand of annual spend in an SOE model. What could go wrong, I ask you? You know, this is an absurdity and it must stop immediately. And that's our position. As far as this is concerned, we have offered them a comprehensive set of reforms that make the NHI utterly irrelevant. And we will get what the Constitution entitles everyone in this country to receive.
Dr. Aslam Dasu, thank you very much indeed. Steering Committee Member of the Universal Healthcare Access Coalition. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A deadly shooting in Sandton last week has predictably reignited debate around private bodyguards, gun ownership, and enforcement failure. I guess the big question is, are regulations too lax, and maybe are private security firms involved in this whole incident, are they properly monitored? I'm joined now by Claire Taylor, research and policy analyst at Gun Free South Africa. Let's take a closer and in-depth look at the state of gun control in South Africa. So Claire, first up, welcome and thank you. This latest Sandton shooting, what does it tell us about gun control and private security in South Africa? What are you worried about?
There are two issues that the shooting highlights. The first is that opportunities in the Firearms Control Act to have prevented the shooting at Solo Restaurant weren't enforced. In particular, the Section 102 of the Firearms Control Act allows the National Police Commissioner to declare people like the perpetrator of the shooting to be declared unfit. The shooting that happened at Solo Restaurant was a carbon copy of a shooting that had happened a year before at Tempo Restaurant, where Mabonga and his bodyguards tried to enter Tempo Restaurant. It's a gun-free zone. They insisted on entering. Tensions escalated with security at Tempo. A shootout ensued and two patrons were wounded. A year later, exactly the same thing happened, this time at Solo Restaurant, and seven people were shot, of whom three died. And under Section 102, the National Police Commissioner should have investigated the fitness of Mabonga, and with the evidence available, it would seem that he would have been declared unfit and his firearm taken away. In addition, the Firearms Control Act includes a provision under which the Minister of Police can declare certain premises, for example, restaurants like Tempo, like Solo, that clearly wanted to prohibit gun ownership on their premises as firearm-free zones. And if that had been the case, those two outlets would have had the power under criminal law to declare somebody like Mabonga as in violation of their firearm-free zone status, and he could have in fact been imprisoned for up to 10 years for violating those restrictions. So it's a failure in terms of implementing the law that we see here.
And in that respect then, Claire Taylor, where is the deficiency? Why do we have a problem in the enforcement of a very clearly demarcated regulation?
I think it's around a lack of accountability. So we see this repeatedly. There was a case recently where a woman who had a protection order against her partner who repeatedly threatened her, the protection order required that the gun be removed and it wasn't. We see the designated firearms officer who was responsible for removing that firearm only having 2 months suspended sentence. She was on leave, paid leave, and she's back at work. Meantime, the woman was shot and killed. We see in the case of Gun Free South Africa's Prince Lou Guns class action that there's been no accountability. So I think we need to be putting pressure on, for example, the Portfolio Committee on Police to ensure that police officials are held accountable. But it's more than that. So Gun Free South Africa also gets increasing complaints from members of the public about bodyguards who are intimidating patrons in restaurants, church congregants, shoppers in complexes around security guards that are carrying firearms openly and intimidating people. And the law is very clear. If anyone carries a firearm in public, it has to be concealed. Gun Free South Africa has approached the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority for clarity on this. They keep fobbing us off. There's been silence. We've requested that members of the public contact the authority directly, and the authority's response has been, it's not our problem, it's the managers of those spaces who you need to consult with. So it's around a much bigger responsibility that the state has for controlling firearms. And I think that there are two aspects around it. The one is that there are clear gaps in the law. For example, we know that the private security industry is four times bigger than our police force, that there's no accountability or oversight over it, and that amendments to the Firearms Control Act aimed to close those loopholes. That law is still sitting in the ether. It needs to be tabled. But also there needs to be accountability, and that involves Parliament taking a bigger oversight measure and also beefing up authorities like the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority, beefing them up to be able to hold the industry accountable.
It's also, so it's greater accountability, but more practically, what about stricter licensing for armed bodyguards, for instance?
So absolutely. And so that would be one of the things that the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority and SAPS needs to work more closely together. And proposed amendments to the Firearms Control Act looked at ways to tighten controls over private security guards and companies in this country.
We have a huge problem with illegal firearms in South Africa. That is a well-documented issue. It would also seem to me that recent gun amnesty programs have had very little impact on firearm-related crime. That's one issue. And secondly, the problem is not going to go away if we continue having this flood of firearms into society.
And I mean, to bring it back to the point around private security companies, so we know that these companies lose, on average, 6 firearms every day, either through loss or theft. And if there's no accountability on that, there's no reporting on that. And so part of Gun Free South Africa's support of amending the Firearms Control Act is that there be greater accountability by the private security companies, both in terms of firearms that are in their possession, firearm losses, but as well as instances around when firearms are used. So IPID, the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, oversees any kinds of and investigates abuses by the police. But there's no such authority doing that around the private security industry. Mm. And so amendments to the Firearms Control Act, and that was in a draft bill that was published in 2021, that looked at ways of increasing oversight over the private security industry. And I mean, Jeremy, you're asking important questions around controls around private security guards. And those are gaps in the law that weren't addressed in the draft amendment bill that was published, and that would need to be looked at to tighten controls over them.
Claire Taylor, thank you very much indeed. Research and policy analyst at Gun Free South Africa. I appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today, Monday the 10th of March. We are live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.